Welcome to episode 50 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson, Michael Lucas Smith, and David Bach. This week we discussed object-oriented databases, relational databases, SQL, and OODBMS storage stuff, and persistence theory in general. If you have comments on this podcast or any other episode in the series, please send them to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com, or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for us, or head on over to iTunes and leave a review.
To you about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be explained to you. Hey,
yeah. Alright, well Dave, the subject was your idea, so why don't you get us started?
Okay.
Hey, have you noticed that James never has a subject, so he's always pointing it off to you or me, Dave?
You finally figured this out? I just facilitate these conversations. I don't come up with any ideas of my own. If I did, I wouldn't be in product marketing.
As I recall in our little Skype chat last night, it was actually James who first typed in the suggestion for the topic.
Hey, can I just go off on a tangent for a second? Sun changing their stock ticker to Java. We should change ours to SD80, right?
There you go. If we had a stock symbol. Yeah, you have to realize that I don't think there's a publicly traded small talk company out there anymore.
I don't believe so. Okay, well, the topic for today is object-oriented databases versus relational databases.
Okay.
Historically, I guess people have used relational databases, and there are various tools to map to them. In fact, the company that I used to work for years ago, called The Object People, had a product called TopLink for Smalltalk, which mapped from Smalltalk to object-oriented, or rather, I keep saying object-oriented, relational databases.
Actually, TopLink still exists too, although only for Java.
Yeah, and they won't release the Smalltalk version.
Oh no, they will. They gave us the same kind of offer that IBM gave for Envy when we asked them if they were interested in licensing that, which is to say they made an offer along the lines of, we don't really want to release this, but if you're really stupid and want to give us this huge pile of money and these absolutely ridiculous licensing terms, we'll be happy to give it to you.
It's the opposite of an offer you can't refuse.
It was an offer that anybody with a half a brain was going to refuse, yes.
Well, they claim that it causes them legal costs to get this all approved and released.
Yet they released the Java version, right?
Well, what it really means is that the Smalltalk source code is locked in a sub-basement somewhere, along with the plans for the throughway from Alpha Centauri.
Since then, Alan Knight has basically rewritten it and called it GLURP. And it turns out nowadays that GLURP is probably a more powerful and more sophisticated version than TopLink Smalltalk was.
There you go, the object people. Everything you did could have been done by one guy.
That's probably true of more software projects than we want to think about. I mean, on another tangent, I was speaking to a guy who's done work both for Microsoft when he was an employee and as a consultant over the weekend at this funeral that I had to attend. And he was telling me that the Windows team consists of 6,000 people.
That's a good manageable size.
So just consider how easy it must be to get anything done with 6,000 people.
Well, you know, the number of people who contribute to the Linux kernel, the GNU system tools, and various other open source projects, including OpenOffice and stuff like that, equals the same number of people working on Microsoft stuff at Microsoft.
Sure, but how many of them are actually regulars is the more interesting question.
Well, I mean, the same would be said about Microsoft employees.
Probably true, but they're...
So the point is that there is a workforce out there that gets paid by a much more distributed income stream, producing just as bad stuff as Microsoft.
There's an encouraging statement about modern technology.
Well, actually, if you want to, going back to databases for a minute, you said that we were doing this
speaking of modern, crappy modern technology, back to databases.
There you go. Well, I was actually going to say that if you go back to databases, we started talking about relational versus object. It turns out the relational was not the first database technology on the scene. If you go back to the beginning, which is when IBM was releasing things like, I think it wasn't IMS first. What was the first one they released? Is it IDMS or?
I don't know if I could.
Yeah, but anyway, when they were releasing those things, Syncom actually released a database way back then around 68, and those databases were hierarchical network databases. So SQL and relational came later. So relational databases were not actually the first thing out of the gate. There was a point in the late 80s when it wasn't necessarily clear whether relational or object or even hierarchical was going to be the wave of the future.
Mind you, I don't ever recall coding in Smalltalk on hierarchical databases.
I don't recall, actually. I mean, I never consulted on projects where the hierarchical database was the main thing, but I worked on projects where there were hierarchical databases that stuff had to be pushed into. I mean, every telecom, for instance, that I ever went into, there was a hierarchical database that had to be dealt with.
Well, if you use any of the active services, service stuff, gee, what's that stuff called?
Active Record? Not Active Record. Microsoft's Active Directory?
Active Directory, and what's it actually based off? LDAP. Yeah, that stuff is a hierarchical database.
Yeah.
Actually, I used a hierarchical database at a bank in Toronto back in 93 or so. So that was an experience. I don't recall much of it, actually. That's fortunate.
But the broader point is that there was a point in time when it wasn't clear that relational was going to be the way that people were going to go. It turned out that object databases didn't win out, and hierarchical databases faded into the background. And I think you could probably put the reasons for that into two categories. One of them was that the relational world pretty much settled on SQL as a cross-database standard, although every relational database has its own proprietary extensions to it that most people take advantage of. But at least in verbal terms, SQL is SQL. And the other reason was that, at least for hierarchical databases, and to some extent object databases worked hard this way, it was perceived to be easier to make changes to a schema of a relational database than it was certainly to a hierarchical database. A hierarchical database, once you had your schema down, it was very hard to change. And object databases got tarred as being the same problem.
Relational databases also had another set of properties that made them kind of more interesting to the general populace for implementing databases than the other kinds. And that's that you could mathematically show how it was going to scale. So you could implement techniques that were mathematical models and actually implement them and have them work and scale exactly the way you'd expect it to scale. So you can't really say the same for object-oriented databases unless you get under the hood. And when you get under the hood with most of these databases, hierarchical databases, relational databases, and object-oriented databases, they're all pretty much doing the same stuff, which is where the whole animosity and competitiveness of between these types of databases gets very funny.
Well, to some extent, yeah, but you while they're doing some very similar things on the bottom layer, the thing about relational databases that I think also had a big impact on them pushing forward was that there are obvious network effects you get into once a technology starts to be accepted widely. You know, SQL became much more common, and then a whole set of tools became common. I mean, one of the complaints I've heard over and over again by people who were looking at, say, Oracle or Sybase or some other relational database, MySQL, Postgres, pick your poison, was that if they use a relational database, they can take a whole set of reporting tools and get stuff that they can throw out to their accountants. Whereas if they pick something else like an Omnibase or a Gemstone, or back in the day there were a bunch of others whose names escape me now, but if they pick an object database, they had to roll their own reporting stuff.
You know, there's no reason why Gemstone couldn't have made a SQL interface. And, it's been around for a while. I'm sure somebody did it.
Well, on the backside, there is a SQL interface to relational databases. You can actually put a relational database behind a Gemstone database and have Gemstone push data to it. I know they have solutions like that because...
I know, but you can actually make SQL and run it across Smalltalk objects in an image.
Yeah, I've seen that done too.
Yeah, so there's no reason why Gemstone couldn't be providing a SQL interface, full stop.
Yeah, I honestly don't know why they haven't done it. Gemstone, actually, I have far less experience with probably than, I don't know, Dave, how much experience do you have with Gemstone?
I worked with Gemstone on three projects, and I have about maybe 3 or 4 years experience on Gemstone.
Okay, well, then that means that Dave knows something about Gemstone, so under no circumstances can we allow him to say anything about it.
Yeah.
The two of us should talk uninformedly about it for the next hour or so.
Yeah, well, you know, Gemstone only works on a 200K machine and runs at only one CPU cycle per second.
Right, Michael, yes. Actually, their newest version only runs on 64-bit machines.
Yeah, which is kind of funny.
Well, but they do have the 32-bit versions as well.
The 32-bit versions are somewhat older versions.
Yeah.
Oh, they haven't updated the 32-bit versions? They are actually kind of leaving those to sit down on back versions?
Well, there's good reasons for it. I mean, if you buy a modern AMD CPU, it's 64-bit anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't say the same for Intel because Intel screwed up their 64-bit plan. But, yeah, I mean, 64-bit's semi-common now. I'm not entirely surprised by their decision, but if you want to grab some sort of commodity web server for $5 a month out on the internet, and that's timeshared sort of thing, and stick your server on there, it's probably not going to be 64-bit. So that's a bit unfortunate, especially since they've entered the seaside arena.
Yeah. Dave, since you've worked with both relationals and Gemstone, and now I'm going to use Gemstone as a proxy for object databases because it's the most prominent one that's out there, to my mind at least. I mean, there are others that are used as embeddable object databases for Java and C++, certainly, and probably in the .NET world too. But,
well, you know, there are some pretty big names for object databases outside of Gemstone.
What's go ahead.
Versant was an object database, wasn't it?
That's one of the ones back in the day that I couldn't come up with, yes.
Zope database?
That's right, the Python Zope database, yeah.
Cache is huge as well.
And Cache is normally used as an embedded database, isn't it?
No.
No, I mean embedded with an application.
Maybe. for some reason, the Squeak guys like GUDS. That's the General Object-Oriented Database System.
Hmm.
So GUDS is an open-source one. It seems to get a bit of airtime.
For a while, didn't Oracle have some object-oriented extensions to their Oracle database?
Oh, they still do, yeah.
Yeah, they still do. They did not discontinue that. What happened is they came out with those. I know this is back when it was Park Place DigiDocker ObjectShare instead of Syncom owning the VisualWorks technology. But we had an interface to that because we had a customer that was interested in it. And the problem was that we discovered that I think most of our customers use Oracle. And there was only ever one customer that it so much as expressed interest in that OR interface that Oracle had. So we built an interface to it. It actually worked pretty nicely. You could do some pretty cool things with it. But nobody had any interest in it.
Let's face it. Oracle has every kind of database under their hood. I mean, they bought BerkeleyDB, which is like the quintessential low-level database driver thingy before you get to relational, hierarchical, or object-oriented. You know, it's the bare roots. They own that now. They've got a completely in-memory, super-fast transactional database thing that they bought off someone else. So they've got that as well. They've got Oracle Spatial for kind of spatial searching with, you know, GPS coordinates, etc. But you can also use it for multidimensional spatial searching, you know, in other words, finding nearby concepts, etc. They've got the Oracle Spatial database now comes with semantic web knowledge capabilities, so you can put RDF triplets in straight into Oracle and do searches off those. And all of these things can be cross-linked. So you can reference data in an RDBMS, reference data in their object store, reference data, you know, all over the place. Oracle is interested in anything and everything database, but they really do push the relational database stuff.
Yeah, but what I was going to try to go back to is since Dave has worked with both Gemstone and with relational databases, I just wanted to get sort of his sense of what the challenges are of working with both.
One of the nice things about working with Gemstone specifically is that the back-end programming language is all actually Smalltalk. In fact, for most projects I was on, we would take the Smalltalk source code in Gemstone and actually store the source into our source code repository, whether it be Envy or Store. And then when we need to, we could push the code back to Gemstone. And in fact, we could have common code running between a client and a server, so that we could have a common definition of a class with common methods either on the client side or the server side, and you can run them on either depending on what your application needs.
Actually, let me interrupt you there briefly to throw in a caveat that a lot of people listening to the podcast might not understand, even small talkers who haven't worked with Gemstone, is that most people, when they think of database, think of data being in the database and the code being in the client or the server if you're talking about a web-based application or a server-based app. In Gemstone, your database is actually a live Smalltalk VM. or set of VMs.
Anybody who gets serious with a web app ends up putting a bunch of optimized functions in the database.
Yeah, they do with stored procedure calls. I understand that. But Gemstone has always been that way, that when you're writing code for Gemstone, you're actually writing it in the database.
Yeah, but I mean, it's essentially the same as having stored procedures.
With Gemstone, if you ignore that policy and start trying to do everything from the client, you're running into huge performance problems. And that would be similar to stored procedures in a relational database. We found huge improvements by pushing code over to the Gemstone side and having Gemstone do it. It's much, much better than trying to pull the objects over to the client side and then having the client try and do the operation.
Right, although honestly, Michael is right that most projects I've ever seen that work with relational databases end up pushing an awful lot of code into the relational server as well with stored procedures.
Well, I mean, one of the real advantages here is that your client software and your server software are using the same language. But if you're programming in, say, Python and using Postgres, you get the same thing. The stored procedures in Postgres are Python. So they're lucky. You know, they've got that advantage, but no other language does, so apart from ours.
And that would be a similar issue with Gemstone. The programming language for Gemstone is Smalltalk. So although you can connect to it from Java or from other languages, when you get to programming Gemstone procedures, you're programming in Smalltalk.
Yeah, I think maybe that's one of the reasons why Gemstone hasn't, you know, had as big a uptake as it possibly could have, is because it advertises itself as being for all these different languages, and then you get into the guts of it and you discover it is... an interface to all these different mm-hmm. languages, but
they're a niche within a niche. They're an object database, and then that's a niche. And then within the niche of object databases, they're using Smalltalk, which again is another niche.
So the big advantage here between the object relational mapping approach and object databases is you don't have to do any kind of mapping. You just talk to the objects.
Exactly. You just
they're local.
You just take the objects and. You can persist them right away, and they just get pushed into the database.
You can get in trouble with that, too. I've seen plenty of shops where they ended up persisting things that they really had no business or even interest in persisting.
Let's be clear here that most developers out there, probably not the people listening to our podcast, but the majority of developers out there using, say, PHP 4 making websites, don't use an object relational mapping system. They just talk to the database in SQL.
Yeah, they just hand code the SQL and send it off.
Right, and they're living in a world where they're happy using multiple languages. They'll use some shell scripts, they'll mm-hmm. use some Python, they'll use some PHP, they'll use some Ruby, and they'll use some SQL.
Right, although ironically, that probably scales better than some of the object relational mappings out there because their database design tends to be simple enough that they're probably not doing an incredibly large number of joins.
Right, and you don't have this kind of disconnect when you go from these are my general operations and now I need to do something tricky because your general operations are SQL and your tricky operation is SQL. Whereas when you're doing object relational mapping, your general operations are just objects, and then you have to jump to the SQL world and unmap everything that the relational system is doing for you to figure out how you're going to do your tricky thing, and then possibly sync that back into the object relational caching system if you've gone and done something tricky-er still. So, I mean, that added complexity does cost you in terms of understanding the whole big picture of your application. Now that I've bagged it, let's talk about why it's such a good idea.
if I could just go back for a minute to a point that James had made earlier about relational databases being easier to change.
That was the theory anyway. I was making the assertion that that's a point I've heard many, many, many times.
Well, maybe I can explain how Gemstone handles that. In Gemstone, you can actually have many different versions of a class stored in Gemstone at the same time. So you don't have, as you would in a regular Smalltalk system, just one version of the class. You can have different versions with different instance variables and different methods. Then different instances can belong to or can be instances of any version of the class. So I could choose to, say, have version 1 of class A and have all sorts of instances with that. When I create version 2, if I don't migrate the old version 1 instances, then there are still instances of version 1, and they'll keep acting that way. And then when I put version 2 objects in, then I'll start creating version 2 objects. The two can coexist.
Well, let me ask a question about that, because I know Gemstone is recently, well, not so recently now, but they announced their support for Seaside as the what they call Glass. Does that mean that you could take and run Seaside version X in your Gemstone Object Server. And then when X.1 comes out, you could also be running X.1 in the same database?
I will say in theory, yes, but I don't know enough about the details to say in practice whether it would work or not.
Let's talk about migration and stuff. With a relational database, unless you have a small amount of data, transforming the schema, it's just not on. You can't do it. It's just too slow. If you have a couple of million records in that database, it takes forever to transform the schema. So people do not do that. It's just simply not. If you get a good DBM, a good DBA, that's not how they'll transform the data. You give them the basic SQL script to transform the schema, and they'll go and rewrite that completely to use in-memory buffer tables, set up a mirror schema, transfer things across, deal with constraints, rebuild it all, and then swap it back. And those techniques are, you know, you need a good DBA to really grok how to do that very well.
And with any long-lived schema, it doesn't migrate very often, even if the schema is not good. I mean, we talked about version control the last three podcasts, and the store schema is not an ideal version of a schema. But because it's been around for so long now, there is some inertia involved in changing that for many of the reasons you just brought up.
And let's also hearken to the days of the mainframe and where that went with relational databases. So this crowd of people who were so stuck on mainframes basically migrated their ideals and understandings of computing to relational databases. And it is incredibly common in any kind of corporate structure to come across a database team. And any migration or change that you intend to do the schema, they'll probably just knock it back and not allow it to happen. And this is incredibly common. So really, the advantages of relational databases are only evident when you're dealing with small databases in an agile team. When you actually get into the big data world with data warehousing, etc., and large corporate databases, you're stuck. So this is where relational database mapping really helps. You want to evolve your object mappings, but you really can't touch the database schema much at all. So Glorp has an incredibly powerful mechanism for mapping your nice objects to crappy database schema without any problems.
And that comes into play in a lot of places because of the fact that, as you said, those corporate database schemas are just effectively static. And then you have to make something web-facing, whether it's internal or external. You might have a relatively static set of schemas for your personnel records. And the internal people need to put up an internally facing web application to support HR applications. And so they're going to have to make sure that whatever object model they pick works against the static schema on the back end.
Now, with Gemstone, you can define a mechanism for migrating an object from an old version of a class to a new version. Now, it is a bit of a process to, say, go search through all the system for instances of that object and migrate it across. And it does take a bit of time, but it is possible to do.
Now, is there an absolute requirement that you do that? Because
No, you just do it incrementally, usually.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean, because, you know, I'm thinking of what I do with BOSS records, you know, serialized objects on disk, and you write the migration code for older versions of the object, but then you don't really care what version of object is stored on disk, so long as when it comes into memory, the system can say, okay, I recognize version 1 of that object, I'll migrate it into memory to version 5, and you might not even ever write it back out.
Could I talk about a different way people have solved this whole schema migration thing?
Sure.
This is a complete sidestep to the regular relational or object management approach. In fact, it fits more in with the world of self and knowledge management. And that is basically dimensional databases. Dimensional and temporal databases. Temporal, not so much, but that's also worth noting because the world of databases is not just limited to relational databases. I mean, so many people just think database, oh, RDBMS, you know, Oracle, SQL Server. They don't really think beyond that. But yeah, there's cool kinds of database architectures out there. Deductive databases, for example, where you can give it a couple of facts and it deduces new facts from that, you know, without actually having to store more data or figure it out yourself. It's cool stuff. But anyway, dimensional databases. Dimensional databases say that entities exist and the properties that you store in them are based in a dimension. So if you have the internal database thing and then you want to do that front-facing application you're talking about, James, where the finance team is adding extra information, they basically just add their extra information in a different dimension on the same entities, and never the twain shall meet, and no schema migration or anything like that is a problem, and it's all there in the one database, and the two bits of information can, if they want, interchange.
Okay, so you're talking, to some extent, you're talking about properties on objects, if you will.
Well, this is the funny thing. Almost every advanced database, somewhere along the line, some developer thinks it's a good idea to put in a properties table.
Yes.
Which basically inverts the table. Instead of being columns and rows, you've now got rows and columns. And it's very slow. You can't really index it well. You can't reflect off it well. It's basically the opposite of what relational database is about, which is describing the data.
It's something that I've done even for my boss storage, and the reason I did it is because it solved schema migration for me. If I added a properties table as a dictionary, then I was able to stop doing schema migration code for version 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of an object.
Well, you have to do less. I mean, if you actually change what the data means, you need to...
If I change what the data means, I have to do schema migration for whatever changed. But if all I ever do is add new entries to the dictionary, I don't need to worry about it.
See, the idea with knowledge systems and dimensional databases is that a relational view or an object view of the data is an interpretation of the data. So if I make version 1 of my class and I back it up to this database, my version 1 of the class and then version 2 of the class are an interpretation of the data that's actually in the database. And that's basically why you don't get these problems, because in the relational database world and object-oriented database world, you're pushing your interpretation as the data. Okay, this is my interpretation of what a person looks like. We'll stick that in the database. Oh, okay, my interpretation has changed now. We have to migrate it. Whereas with dimensional databases, you say, my interpretation of the data is what I do with it once I've read it out, but the slots that exist on this entity in the database and these dimensions is purely agile, flexible, can be whatever it wants, and it's not really an issue. It's a different way of dealing with the stuff, and it has its own challenges with making it efficient, etc. And you don't really see commercial databases that do this sort of thing. I believe there is a module in Oracle to do this sort of thing.
Is there a module? I don't think Oracle misses any of those things, as you mentioned earlier. They probably have modules to do just about anything you could imagine.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a completely different way of doing it. So the reason why you don't see it so much is because it's actually kind of new. In terms of understanding frames and frame reference theory, knowledge management theory, structured information theory, all that kind of stuff, and how it relates to deduction and inferencing and all that kind of reasoning stuff. And all of this stuff is still reasonably new and still mostly stuck in academia. And it didn't really hit that point that relational databases hit where they said, look, we can mathematically model this. Let's go and build it.
Well, to some extent, what you can say about database technology is just like C language syntax got to be the mainstream of programming languages, SQL and relational got to be the mainstream of database technology. And just as there are languages, obviously like Smalltalk and then Lisp and other things that are out there that are not C-like, there are other database technologies that are not relational-like, but relational is the mainstream around which everybody centers.
Yeah.
So let me go back to Dave for a minute. You talked about schema migration in Gemstone, and we've touched on it in relational. Since you've worked on both relational projects and OODBMS projects, which ones would you know, what are the different challenges and benefits of each? You know, which one would you say was more pleasant for you to work on, and which one was, to some extent, more pleasant for the end customer to get?
I find as an object-oriented developer, it's much more comfortable going to an object-oriented database. So I tend to prefer a Gemstone for that reason. When I go to SQL, it always there's always the mapping issue between the SQL and the objects that I'm using, and the programming language that I use to program the database is SQL. It's stored procedures, which is different than the programming language that I use to develop, which is Smalltalk. So there's always that dichotomy between them. I find quite often with relational, people will not create stored procedures, and they'll just use the relational database as a dumping ground for the data and then do all the processing on the client. You don't find that as much in object databases, at least in Smalltalk, because the Smalltalk developers, well, if you have your application, your client application in Smalltalk and your database in Smalltalk, you tend to push the requirement.
It's easier to move the code, yeah.
Yeah, you push the responsibility to the right place.
Yeah, well, I'd say any project that reaches a non-trivial size probably ends up moving to stored procedures and more processing on the server. I mean,
getting back for a moment to the migration, it is an issue with Gemstone that you have to decide whether you're going to migrate all instances or just any new ones you create. And different projects I've seen have used different philosophies. It is actually quite difficult to manage a system where you don't migrate the old instances across to to the new classes, because then you don't know quite what version of code you're using, and it's harder to keep the old objects working well. In recent projects I've been working on, we just take the philosophy that we always migrate all of our objects over as soon as we create a new version of the class. So as a policy, we'll do that.
I mean, one of the things you said was that you have to deal with this whole mapping thing. In Active Record, in Ruby on Rails, and now in Glorp, it's nowhere near as much of a problem. I mean, it pretty much matches one-to-one with what you're doing, except in the circumstances where it doesn't, and then you have to write code anyway. But yeah, you make your person class, and there's a person table, and you put in the instance variables first name, last name, and there are first name, last name like columns. It'll just do all that stuff for you.
Yeah, I find it amusing that the relatively trivial approach that these technologies use to database mapping match right over to the very simplistic approach I was using for demonstrations a decade ago. I mean, not that I was presaging it or anything, but it seemed like the simplest thing that could work for a quick demo.
Yeah. Well, it does work. You should have written Glorp all that time ago, James.
As you probably heard me say, I've spent the last 10 years desperately trying to avoid databases.
Well, with Active Record, the advantage that they have is that they define the database schema, and the database schema isn't defined by another team for another purpose.
Yeah, when you hit that corporate database structure, yeah, you got to deal with the crap.
That's also why I think Ruby on Rails has had difficulty penetrating your enterprise-y shops.
Yeah, when you get past the simple stuff, it kind of falls down, but Glorp
doesn't.
Well,
no, that's not even what I meant. What I was talking about is the fact that the application wants to define the database tables runs right into that corporate DB shop problem that you talked about earlier. It has nothing to do with Rails or Ruby per se. It has to do with that political issue of who owns the database.
Yeah, I wrote an application once that would dynamically create the database anytime you change the shape of classes in the Smalltalk image. It got rejected.
That sounds efficient, yeah.
It got rejected because not because of the efficiency problems. That was actually pretty neat, some of the tricks it did, but because there was just no shop client of ours that would actually allow it to be run on their database because the DBMs control the database. And
on the DBAs probably had their hair falling out and their heads exploding at the very concept.
Yeah,
and there's an extra challenge if you have to deal with an existing database that was used in a previous project. And it has a certain structure, and that's what the structure is, and you have to map to it. A solution like Ruby on Rails just doesn't work very well.
Right, which, again, has less to do with Ruby or Rails and more to do with the politics of the shop you're talking about.
Yeah, possibly so.
Well, with that, I'm going to say that we're over 30 minutes, and that's probably as long as we want to give to this.
Well, if you, you know, include all the crap that we had at the start before Dave got on... I've got 40 minutes.
I think I'll include that in it as a blooper reel at the end.
Oh, the blooper reel. Hey, we've almost come up to a year.
Yeah, this is episode 50. We're actually at a half century mark with this episode.
Oh, cool.
And that means that 2 weeks from now, if I can figure out how to use the same approach Michael used to come up with the previously unindustry misinterpretations a couple weeks ago, I can come up with a best of episode for 52.
Yeah, best of, yeah. It's going to be like a couple of seconds.
Well, what we'll do is we'll have Dave saying burn over and over again.
Burn.
burn. Okay, so I guess we'll see you next week then.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Next up is David Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. You often see cases where your code needs to do some setup before performing some operation, and then some teardown afterward. If the setup and teardown are in different parts of your system, it's hard to see that they're matched up. I like to try and put the setup and the teardown into the same method, and ideally have the teardown as part of an ensure clause of the processing to make sure that the teardown always happens. If the setup and teardown are in different parts of the system, then it's hard to verify visually that the system actually works properly and that the teardown is actually run. For example, if you need to process data from a file, have one method that opens the file, calls processing, and then in an ensure block has code to close the file. This way you can visually see from that one method that the close will always be called properly. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented programming and the Smalltalk programming language. We'll be offering an Introduction to VisualWorks programming course on the week of September 17th. To register or for more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
And here's James Savage with this week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. After several weeks of low activity on the job front, we have an uptick this week, starting with Britain. Now, Ross reports that in Glasgow, JP Morgan Chase is again looking for capital developers. They are looking for experience with OO systems and Smalltalk, experience with banking or financial services. Shell scripts, Unix, and XML are considered pluses. London, UK. Morgan Hutchkins Associates and McGregor Broyle are looking for a Smalltalk developer, risk support developer. Experience with financial derivatives, interest or experience, and Unix are considered pluses. These permanent positions pay 50k to 70k pounds per year, and they might also be working for the capital project. In Leeds, Yorkshire, UK, Computer People and Sandstone Technology are looking for a Smalltalk developer. J2EE, Java, and Visual Age are considered pluses. This three-month contract pays 350 to 450 pounds per day. Bob Nemec, our Canadian contributor, reports that in Toronto, Ontario, Hayes Specialist Recruitment is looking for a QA analyst who has experience with Java, Smalltalk, and web services. Ottawa, Ontario. Procom is looking for a senior systems analyst who has experience with Eclipse, Gemstone, IMS, Java, Smalltalk, and Sybase. Richard Pearson, our East Coast contributor, reports that in Newark, New Jersey, Manpower Professional and Win IT Explorer are looking for a Smalltalk developer for a 5-plus-month contract who has experience with Visual Age. Experience that is considered a plus includes DB2, Envy, Excel, and XML. These are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
And that about wraps it up for this week's Industry Misinterpretations. Something new that you can do for feedback to us is join the Industry Misinterpretations group over at Facebook. Of course, you can head on over to iTunes and leave a review, head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote, or send email to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. If you send that in MP3 audio form, we'll play it on the air. Till next week, have fun with Smalltalk.
To you about the things you've been putting me through. Now I gotta talk to you, I gotta be explained to you.
That just means we can be as organized as we always are.
You know, you can cut these bits out, James.
I can cut these parts out, you mean?
Uh-huh.
I thought that wasn't possible. I thought I had to include the whole thing.
I'm having audio troubles, can't hear anything. Good work, Dave. We can't hear you and you can't hear us.
Huh?
Just waiting for Dave.
Hopefully this isn't like when I was trying to get audio working with my dad on an IM system. He had his microphone hooked up to the line out. He was wondering why all he was getting on his end was a weird feedback noise. I should just turn the audio recording off. This part's not going to have any value.
Oh, this is good stuff. You know it. Yeah.
Now, if you get off the line, I'll get rid of all the parts of you I have to doubt, too.
Just leave you in. You just have a one-sided conversation.
How would that be different from any other day? So at the end of each trip, I end up with a buttload of coins that just all they end up doing is adding about 10 pounds to my return home.
Well, it's certainly easier than having, you know, $51 notes, that's for sure.
Come on. If you run ahead where you are in Ottawa, that could be fuel in the winter if you run out of heat, dude. As compelling as this audio is, I think I'm going to turn the recording off.